Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info.
Welcome back to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
So let's talk about that case, Kevin Randall, you were about to bring up in our previous segment. Go ahead.
As I say, it took place in, I think, 1967 in Austin, Texas. The guy got a good look at the thing. They filled out the forms. They sent it off to the Air Force, and it was classified as insufficient data for scientific analysis. Well, the witness was just enraged by this. And you can see in the correspondence again, he wants to know what information didn't he provide? What more did they need to know to make any kind of a analysis of his sighting? You know, he's given him the direction. He's given him the time. He's given him the altitudes. He's given him the description of what transpired. He's given him all this information. And they said insufficient data for scientific analysis. Eventually, they classified it as unidentified. They didn't have an answer. But when you look at the Project Blue Book files, you find out that some 30 or 40% of the cases are labeled as insufficient data for a scientific analysis, which means they're not explained. They're simply not in that unidentified category. They were able to limit the number of unidentifieds in the Project Blue Book files to something like 701 out of 12,000 cases. But then you look at the 4,500 cases that are insufficient data, and then you look at some of the other cases where they've appended solutions like level land that are preposterous. You could say as many as 50 or 60% of the sightings really aren't identified. And yet there are skeptics out there who are going through the unidentifieds and trying to explain those. And clearly, our knowledge in today's environment, our scientific knowledge, allows us to explain some cases that we couldn't explain back then. And our access to what were formerly classified projects allows us to explain some cases that we couldn't explain back then. I think of the Charles Whitted case specifically, which in 1948, these two airline pilots claimed that they saw a cigar-shaped object whiz by their airliner. It was cigar-shaped, had a row of square windows, double row of square windows, and a flame out the back, some kind of a rocket. Originally, I think it may have been Hynek, said something about it being meteoric, and they said, no, we don't know what it is. It's unidentified. Well, then we get to the Zond 4 reentry, which I alluded to a little bit earlier, and that was a spacecraft that returned and was breaking up. And a number of people who saw it thought it was a cigar-shaped craft with square windows on it with a flame out the back. You go to, it used to be on YouTube, it was called Meteor Compilation. It was 3 minutes and 19 seconds long. And it was somebody put together all these videos of meteors breaking up in the atmosphere that he'd collected from YouTube and put them all together. And you could see how somebody catching part of this out of a corner of an eye for a split second could get the idea of a lighted cockpit and windows behind a flaming object. And you could see how people could make that mistake. So I think the Charles Whitted case is explainable as a meteor because it's 1948, so it's clearly not returning space debris. Jerry Clark and I disagree on that. Jerry Clark still thinks it's a very good sighting. I think it's explainable based on what we know today and other examples of that sort of thing. So we can do some of that as well. But there's a great number of cases that just don't have any kind of real explanation. One of those cases, and I talk about it in the Best of Project Blue Book, is a sighting that took place in 1954, I believe. The Condon Committee, which was the University of Colorado study of UFOs, paid for by the Air Force, and the Air Force said, here's what we want you to find, and the Condon Committee in their study said, oh, here's what we found, exactly what the Air Force wanted. Which, of course, the UFOs pose no threat to national security, that the Air Force had done a good job investigating them, and the project should be closed. And all those findings were enumerated in the final report. But they had one sighting that always kind of intrigued me, which they said was they labeled it as a natural phenomenon so rare it had never been seen before or since. And I'm thinking, didn't you just sort of describe a flying saucer? But I'm also thinking that they said, well, you know, we could learn nothing of scientific value by continued studying of UFOs. And I'm thinking, if you've got a natural phenomenon like that, wouldn't that actually induce you to want to find out what it was and provide something of scientific information to it? And so, I, you know, it's not a very long chapter in the book. It's a short chapter. The documents are there to show what was seen and a newspaper article about it. And the pilots were interrogated by the military. And one of the other crew members, wasn't one of the pilots, it may have been a third pilot on the aircraft or a navigator or something like that. He wasn't brought in for interrogation, and he asked them what that had been all about, and they said, well, we can't tell you about it. So now we've got a very interesting sighting that we really don't have a lot of information about, but it's quite intriguing. And you can see how the information was manipulated by the military and then the Condon Committee to reject this sighting. With the Levelland sightings, which had taken place, as I mentioned, in 1957, so 10 years later, the Condon Committee is doing his investigation, so it's not that distant. You could have found the witnesses had you wanted to look. The only reference in the Condon Committee report to Levelland is, well, they had talked to a woman who in 1967 said her car had been stalled by a UFO, and they conducted what they called magnetic mapping of her hood to see where the compass would point as they placed it in different places on the hood, and then did the same thing to cars of similar make at the similar time from the similar plant to see if there was any deviation. They actually found a couple of deviations that they found weren't important. Then they said, well, we don't understand how a car could be stalled, and then when the electromagnetic field is removed, the car would spontaneous start. And that got me to thinking, what is it the reports really say? And you go back and you look at them, and I looked at all the ones that Mark Rodiker did in his massive analysis of the electromagnetic effects where cars were stalled and that sort of thing. So it took place over many, many years, not just Levelland. And what I found by looking through that is nobody really asked the key question. And it came out of Levelland where the object took off and then they said the car started properly. They didn't say that it started spontaneously, and nobody asked them, well, did you turn the key? Did you have to start it yourself? Which is a critical question that nobody thought to ask back in 1957. And you go through a lot of the cases, and they talk about the car starting normally. And you can interpret that to mean that it just regenerated, it spontaneously restarted. Or the person did something, pushed the starter, turned the key, did something, and the car started normally and worked normally after the object had left the area. And you go through the reports, and it's really not clear how the car started, except in a couple of them where they do say, well, when the object left, the car started again. So it's not as ambiguous as most of the entries. The Condon Committee was able to overlook the electromagnetic effects because one woman reported electromagnetic effects, and they were unable to reproduce them, and they found her story to be a little bit shaky. And granted, her story is a little bit shaky, but you shouldn't reject all of the electromagnetic effects that you see because one woman's report wasn't as solid as it could have been. And there's any number of other cases they could have looked at. They could have talked to the sheriff. They could have talked to some of the people who saw the object in 1957 and got their take on it because many of those people were still around and hadn't left the area. So they could have done that had they wanted to, but they avoided that. And you go through the Condon report and you see they avoided some other investigations that might have led them in a direction they didn't want to go. And it's the same thing with the Air Force investigations. Sometimes they just didn't want to go in a certain direction. There's any number of cases in the Blue Book files that are listed as information only, and they've got like newspaper clippings or something like that, or they'll say not case but information only. So they gathered the information, but they did nothing with it. And then there's an awful lot of cases that are just flat missing from the Project Blue Book files as well. So you've got a real problem there. And I look at some of that in the Best of Project Blue Book and try to bring some kind of newer information to it, because of course I can look at it from the perspective of 2020 and say, here's all the other information I was able to gather after the sighting was over and by the people who were involved. You know, like I said, I talked to Carl Hart Jr. in the mid-1990s and got his take on it, on his sighting. So I could bring that to the table that many others couldn't do.
Let me ask you a question here that we can frame for our next segment, and that is, in putting this book together, what surprised you about things that were overlooked in the early cases, and we're kind of covering some of it now, but maybe get more specific on other cases where I wonder why this wasn't done, or if we knew then what we knew now, we'd have this answer. What we do know is that Kevin Randall will be joining us also on this weekend's edition of the After the Paracast podcast. Part of a Paracast Plus subscription. For more info, check theparacast.plus, the best at Project Blue Book. The author is Kevin D. Randall. I'm Gene. He's Randall Murphy. You're in
the Paracast.
As you know, neighbors, web hosting can be pretty cheap, but not all hosting is the same. DreamHost wins best of awards year after year. You get unlimited disk space, unlimited bandwidth, and even the low-cost plans put your sites on high-performance SSDs. Want to know more about what DreamHost has to offer? Go to technightowl.com/host. Once again, that's technightowl.com/host.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there is The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
So you're wearing a mask every day now?
Yeah.
Where are you getting them?
Same website where I get my neck and body wraps, sunnybay.com.
Really?
And they're handmade, just like their wraps in the USA.
Oh, and good quality?
Oh, very good. These are disposable face masks, and they make cloth face masks, too.
Good price?
That's the best part. 10 masks for only $6.
Wow.
As a public service, sunnybay.com is now making cloth face masks by hand in the Seattle area and sourcing disposable face masks with level 1 protection at sunnybay.com. Get a 10-pack of high-quality disposable face masks for only $6, or choose a handmade, washable, reusable cloth face mask with high 2 layers of quality cotton fabrics. Supplies are limited. Get details and order at sunnybay.com, a Biomed DB design company. Go to sunny-bay.com for disposable or cloth face masks. Just click sunny-bay.com. That's sunny-bay.com.
This is George Norrie from Coast to Coast AM and History Channel's Ancient Aliens. We support the amazing energy, nutrition, and skincare products from Jeunesse. Jeunesse products are designed by leading doctors in their field with natural ingredients and even stem cell technology. These products help your body perform and look better. Shop Jeunesse at GCNLife.com or call 1-844-443-6637. GCNLife.com or 844-443-6637.
Jake was in big trouble with the IRS. He owed how much?
$92,000.
Ouch. The IRS left no room for Jake to breathe.
They put a lien on my house, took all the money out of my bank account, took money out of my paychecks. So it was a nightmare.
He needed help fast.
I figured that all these companies were the same until I called Federal Tax Management. You could just tell they knew what they were talking about. Right then and there, I felt like I had some hope.
Stop the liens, levies, and garnishments fast and qualify for one of several special IRS programs that could reduce or even eliminate your tax debt. So, how'd it go for Jake?
They did what they said they would do. They came through for me. I ended up saving an unbelievable amount. I was so jazzed. I was extremely happy.
If you owe more than $10,000 in back taxes, take Jake's advice.
Give Federal Tax Management a phone call. If they help me, they can help anybody.
Call the Federal Tax Management Hotline now. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625.
Hi, this is Dr. Joel Wallach, the Mineral Doctor. You've heard me talk about 90 for life for years. 60 minerals, 16 vitamins, 12 amino acids, 2 fatty acids. You may not know this, that I've actually designed Arthrodex for animals. That's right. Your pets need 90 for life, too. Get this essential pet product by calling 877-279-9422. That's 877-279-9422. Again, 877-279-9422.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
So, Kevin Randall, framing my crazy question here. Things surprised you about what you came across doing this book? Things that overturned earlier explanations, because we know now so much more than we knew then, we hope.
What springs to mind immediately is the Socorro landing from 1964. Lonnie Zamora, the police officer who saw landed craft, saw alien creatures, saw some kind of beings, landing traces left behind. As I said, he was a police officer. I was interviewing Ben Moss and Tony Angiola on my radio program. And during the course of the program, they said three people had called the police station prior to Lonnie Zamora seeing the thing. And they hadn't bothered to write anything down, or nobody bothered to gather more information. I said, well, did you look at the police logs to see if it was logged? And I never got an answer to that question. And it got me interested in that. So going through the Project Blue Book file, I found a report written that night by a Captain Richard Holder. Now, Holder was an Army captain. He was stationed at the White Sands Missile Range, but his actual duty station, because the White Sands Missile Range is huge, as anybody who looks at a map of New Mexico knows, goes from Alamogordo almost all the way to Socorro. And his duty station was actually closer to Socorro than it was to Alamogordo, so he lived in Socorro. So within 90 minutes of Lonnie Zamora seeing the object and it taking off, Holder is talking to Zamora along with an FBI agent. So that night, Holder writes a report. It's a short report, half a page, single space, that he calls into the Pentagon. And in the course of that report, he says that the police station had gotten three calls that night about the thing before Lonnie Zamora had seen it. So we have the documentation now. We know that people called into the police station about seeing this thing. What really is surprising, nobody ever bothered to look into that, to find more about it. I did a book called Encounter in the Desert about the Zamora case and go into great detail about all this sort of stuff. And it's mentioned in Project Blue Book as well. You know, here is documentation of other witnesses. So now Socorro is no longer a single witness case. Albeit Lonnie Zamora is a very credible witness, it's no longer single witness. It's got a number of other witnesses. Talking to Ray Stanford, he said that he had talked to a couple of women in New Mexico within a week or 10 days, something like that, of the sighting. They had seen something in the sky as well, and he took some information. I asked him who they were, and he said, well, it's in my notes. I don't know who they are. And I'm thinking, if we could find out who they were, and we could find a phone book or something from 1964, which isn't that hard to find, we might be able to find some other witnesses in the area. Granted, you know, looking at this in the late 2000 teens, it's a long shot, but it's possible we might have been able to locate some other witnesses in the Socorro area. At worst case scenario, we would have gotten a better view of the flight path of the thing because we would have known where the witnesses were when they saw the object. But that was one thing that surprised me was that we had additional witnesses, so it's not a single witness case anymore. We've got some good witnesses about that. The other thing that surprised me is looking at what Hector Quintanilla had written. He was in charge of Project Blue Book in 1964. He, in fact, basically closed it out. I say basically, there was a lieutenant, Carmen Morano, who was the last officer in charge, and his job was really to gather the files and close out the office and all of that stuff after Hector Quintanilla had left. You know, you look at all of that sort of thing, you get a different idea of what was going on in 1964. So Quintanilla is sent to New Mexico. He goes to New Mexico. He's got orders that says he has a top secret clearance, and he's supposedly granted access to all the top secret projects going on at Holloman Air Force Base on White Sands Missile Range. And his orders he carries with him says they're supposed to cooperate with him. So he goes down there and he thinks he's going to find an explanation, and he can't do it. He finds nothing in the classified projects going on in these locations that would explain what Lonnie Zamora had seen. In the end of his book, he said that he was sure that the explanation was somewhere in Lonnie Zamora's brain, meaning that Lonnie Zamora had seen something or knew something that he hadn't talked about that would explain the sighting completely, but he didn't know what it was, and he reluctantly labeled the sighting as unidentified, knowing, and he actually says this, knowing that the UFO hobbyists would go nuts when it came out that the Air Force had been unable to identify what Lonnie Zamora saw because it involved a landed craft, and it involved him seeing two beings outside the craft for a period of time, a short period of time, granted that. You look at the Project Blue Book files, I think there are only three cases in the Project Blue Book files where people reported seeing beings associated with the craft that aren't labeled as psychological, meaning the person reporting it has some kind of psychological problems. If you see a landed UFO and the creatures from inside, well, clearly you have psychological problems, is their rationale. It doesn't mean that they looked at that, but it was Zamora, they didn't say that. And there's one or two other cases where they didn't say that. They were quite candid about not being able to find an explanation. So anyhow, that was one of the things that springs to mind immediately, is looking at the Zocoro case and realizing that there's much more to it than we had thought or had been reported. And like I said, I did Encounter in the Desert, which explores this in great depth. And then in Project, the Best Project Blue Book, I have a synopsis of the case that outlines some of these other witnesses, some of this other information. So you get an idea that the Zocoro case is much more important than I think the skeptics and some of the UFO field have led us to believe.
Then again, I ran across, when I was looking into that as well, that Quintanilla believed the Zocoro landing incident was connected with the lunar excursion module from the Apollo program, some kind of classified, whether it was a test vehicle or a related vehicle, and of course, he stuck to that right to the very end.
No, I don't think Quintanilla ever did that.
Yeah, he did, for sure. I've looked it up in several places. So I don't know how you missed it.
I have his book. He wrote himself personally his book, and he says in his book he doesn't know what Zamora saw. He has no explanation for it. The case is labeled as unidentified. The skeptics have come out with the lunar lander explanation, but when you look at the documentation, it wasn't available in New Mexico in 1964. To be landing other than a mock-up of it that they were testing using a helicopter. And Lonnie Zamora says nothing about a helicopter. There's nothing to suggest a helicopter involved. It was a craft that was able to land itself and take off by itself without any kind of other support.
I would also think, Kevin, that a helicopter is a pretty noisy device. I mean, you obviously know better than any of us here, but I haven't been that far from flying helicopters. And boy, it does make its presence known.
Yeah, and that's another point. And had it been a helicopter, that explanation would have been found. I mean, the helicopter lunar lander explanation would have found immediately. But the documentation does not support that. And Quintanilla, clearly in his book, I mean, he wrote it with an eye to being very, very skeptical. I mean, he hated Hynek, and he hated the idea of alien spacecraft, and he hated the people who believed in UFOs. So had he had any sort of inkling that he had an explanation, even if it was a far-fetched one, he was going to put it down and run with that explanation.
We hope you will not hate these announcements. We hope you won't hate these announcements. We've got a few here. And then we'll get back with Kevin D. Randall. And Gene and Randall, you're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Anytime, any place, anywhere, radio remains the most intimate of all forms of media. At home, at work, in the car, on smartphones. Over 90% of consumers still listen to radio every week. That makes choosing radio as a place to advertise your business one of the best decisions you can make. Email advertise@gcnlive.com and partner up with an experienced GCN representative. Advertise@gcnlive.com. Easy, affordable, effective.
Houseflies defecate every 4 to 5 minutes, spreading diseases and germs. Protect your food and your health with Bug Assault, a miniaturized shotgun which utilizes ordinary table salt as ammunition. Non-toxic, no batteries required, only $39.95. Use discount code GCN and get an extra 10% off your purchase at bugassault.com. Fire your fly swatter. Get your Bug Assault today.
USA Radio News with Wendy King.
President Trump says he wants Americans to go back to church. He's declared them to be essential.
The governors need to do the right thing and allow these very important essential places of faith to open right now for this weekend. If they don't do it, I will override the governors. In America, we need more prayer not less.
Some governors say the president can't order them to open churches, but the Justice Department has already been warning states they cannot let businesses reopen while keeping churches closed. They also sent a letter to LA's mayor warning that extending stay-at-home orders may be unlawful. This while Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer has extended their stay-at-home orders for another 3 weeks, despite declining infections and increasing protests. This is USA Radio News. The Jersey Shore is reopening for Memorial Day, but things aren't quite the same. USA Radio Network's John Hunt is in the area and gives us a peek from his perspective.
Beaches are reopening all around the country for Memorial Day weekend, including the Jersey Shore, with the coronavirus still stalking the state and the rest of the USA. Not everything will be the way it used to be. Signs around the area said social distance today starts spreading the news. No arcades, no rides, no concerts or special events, closed playgrounds, capacity limits on beaches, long lines to use the few public bathrooms that will be open, and just takeout at most bars and restaurants, with drones flying overhead to help authorities monitor it all. Police and other security will be out on the sand to make sure people keep 6 feet apart, and lifeguards will blow the whistle on anyone who does not follow the new rules. For USA Radio News, I'm John Hunt.
You're listening to USA Radio News.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy of my lecture that tells you exactly how to do it. In fact, after you've lived a long and healthy life, there should be only two documents in your medical chart, a birth certificate and a death certificate. I'm Dr. Wallach with a warning. If you have a 4-inch medical chart, if you take prescription drugs for high cholesterol, high blood pressure, arthritis, joint pains, and other health issues, the medical profession is failing you. They're using you for an ATM machine. My free lecture is going to reveal what pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know. There's been groundbreaking research and discoveries on how to effectively treat or eliminate over 900 different diseases naturally. And it's all in my free lecture called Deadly Recipe. So call toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. Again, that's toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. 1-855-79-YOUNG.
Author of the UFO Encyclopedia and other books. You're listening to the Paracast.
When we have Randall and Randall, it gets confusing, but people say I'm confused already. So there you go. So we have a writer here who is really, really desperately seeking to express hatred of UFOs. It's emotionally involved, huh?
Well, no, Quintanilla's not a writer. He's in charge of Project Blue Book.
Sure. But we have the guy who's writing down these criticisms.
Proposed explanations.
Sure.
But the point is, in his own book, I mean, his private book, he says no. He says he doesn't know what it was. And that was after his investigation. I think that some of the skeptics and some of the writers have glommed onto this lunar lander explanation. And I've seen that myself. I just don't buy it. Tony Bagaglia has suggested some kind of balloon joke being played on Zamora by students. First it was high school students who were tired of getting speeding tickets from Zamora, and then it was students at the New Mexico Institute of Mining and School of Mining Technology, or whatever the hell the name of it is, there in Socorro, had done it, and they were supposedly famous for creating these great hoaxes and jokes to play on people. But you look at the evidence, you look at what was going on, there's absolutely nothing to support this idea that it was some kind of joke. Tony got one of the former presidents of the school to say that, he heard that the students had done it as some kind of joke, and he said, that kind of proves it. But Hynek had talked to the guy who was president of the school in 1964. Hynek was there. He talked to the head of the school, and the head of the school said he didn't know what it was. Tony has said to me he's talked to a student who participated in it, but he won't give me the name, and I haven't talked to the guy. I'd like to hear his side of the tale to see what was going on, but there really is no good explanation for what Lonnie Zamora saw, and I know that the skeptical community is kind of locked into the lunar lander, but the documentation just doesn't support that.
It's also not uncommon for people to say, I did it, And they're just making up stories, so who knows. We've invited Tony to come on the Paracast, and maybe someday in the next 25 years he will. And we'll keep it open. If I'm still here and I'm still semi-coherent, as opposed to whatever I am now, we'll certainly invite him. Speaking of Dr. Hynek, just very briefly, they canceled the Project Blue Book TV show after 2 years, which I guess is a mixed bag. But the thing about it is, I watched, I think, one episode, and it didn't impress me too much. What did you think?
I liked the first season because they didn't stray too far afield. They did some things that were kind of annoying, but they didn't stray too far afield. I talked to Paul Hynek. I talked to one of the senior vice president for programming for the A&E networks on the program to get his take on what was going on. So I looked at it, and I could separate the fact from the fiction. And it may be because I was familiar with the cases. I knew where they were going wrong and where they were holding close to the hold of the truth. They went off into the Soviet espionage thing and things like that, and that was okay. I kind of enjoyed the first season, but the second season just went completely and totally nuts. Hynek's get involved in fist fights for crying out loud. There's Russian spies. There's a murder or two taking place. The general is waterboarding some witness from Roswell. Roswell has nothing to do with Blue Book because, Blue Book didn't exist at the time. And the only reference to Roswell in the entire Project Blue Book files is a single paragraph in a single newspaper article in another case file where it just says, I think it's the third paragraph in the story, says something to the effect that the officers at Roswell were issued a blistering rebuke for their reporting of capturing a flying saucer. And that's the only remembrance of Roswell in the Project Blue Book files, and yet they have this whole scenario of witnesses walking the field, picking up the debris, and all kinds of nonsense like that. I got so bored with it, I stopped watching it. When I learned it was canceled, I applauded quite a bit. I thought it was a good thing they canceled it because I was afraid that people were going to believe some of that stuff. And the reason I say that, my mother told me once that George Custer had been promoted to Brigadier General by mistake. Well, if you read the history, you find out it was no mistake. Almost all regular Army officers ended up as generals during the Civil War because they were forming so many units, and so many were volunteer units, they wanted the regular officers at the very top, the guys who had been trained in the military. And so almost everybody who graduated from West Point prior to the beginning of the Civil War ended up as a general during the war. Where she got that was a movie called They Died With the Boots On, where a letter of reprimand was being written to George Custer. And the adjutant had just written his name on Lieutenant George Custer, and then he was told to write an order promoting the senior brigadier or senior colonel in this brigade to general. And by mistake, he'd written the address on the piece of paper, and it was covered up. And he wrote the order out, and he sent it off, and it said Custer was going to be promoted to brigadier general, so he took over. The point is, she believed he'd been promoted to brigadier general by mistake, but it's. She got it out of a movie. And I was worried that that kind of thing would happen with Project Blue Book. People would see things there and think, that's the way it really happened.
Now, the thing that bothers me is Robert Zemeckis, who was executive producer in the project, is somebody who's one of the best film directors we have. Obviously, the story's gone away from them. But I would have thought there's enough exploring Dr. Hynek, not just within Project Blue Book, but after he left, to make a credible series. They didn't have to go into the 19th dimension and jump the shark there.
Yes, absolutely. And I've said the same thing. I mean, you're talking about alien visitation. What could be more exciting about that? And yet they got to jazz it up. And you see this in movies all the time. They'll take a historical event, which is quite exciting in and of itself, and they've got to throw in all this other ancillary stuff to make it more exciting. Let's put in a few car chases and an explosion. Hynek was not involved in any car chases. They didn't drive into a underground base at Dulce as they did in this program. I don't know if Hynek ever getting involved in a fist fight in his life.
I don't see him as an action hero, but I describe the character during the first season. I said I just saw one episode. As trying to make him into an action hero, and those who knew him even slightly would say he was totally the reverse of anything you might regard as an action hero.
But you have to remember the guy who played Hynek in the program was Littlefinger in Game of Thrones, so maybe there was some carryover there.
Ladies and gentlemen, I should admit, I have never seen Game of Thrones. I'm quite aware of the program. Don't know that I want to see Game of Thrones, though I'm running out of things to watch right now because a lot of the TV series ended early because of coronavirus, and the new seasons will start late. And the only big thing, of course, is the person who played Batwoman will no longer play that role, but who cares? Anyway, and there'll be the Zack Snyder cut of Justice League coming to HBO Max. But nobody cares about that either. But I agree with you just on the surface here that they really probably went in the wrong direction with Project Blue Book. Did you talk to Paul Hynek after the first season about what he thought, what they did?
My thought was when I watched a couple of shows, I thought, what does Hynek family think about this? Because I was kind of annoyed about the way they were portraying Hynek. And so I talked to Paul Hynek about it, and he thought it was great. Didn't mind it at all.
Maybe he didn't mind the fact they wrote him a check. I mean, seriously, you do get money from a company that's going to use your likeness as the character in a weekly TV show. They obviously have to send a check.
He may have enjoyed the role that he played in that, and talking to the senior vice president. I mean, they were very credible guys. In fact, the senior vice president eventually sent me a picture of him with Robert Friend. Robert Friend had been one of the officers in charge of Project Blue Book in 1959-1960 era. And I didn't know this until later, and I wished I had. A friend had been one of the Tuskegee Airmen. And I thought, well, there's an interesting tidbit of history. And I would have loved to talk to him about that, those experiences, but I never got a chance to do that because I didn't realize he'd been a Tuskegee Airman. So I think, they were all doing Project Blue Book, and they didn't really get too far afield. I worried about the somewhat lesbian relationship kind of developing between Mimi Hynek and the Soviet spy. I mean, they didn't really go anywhere.
Let's stop it right here. We've got more to come with Kevin Randall, J. Randall Murphy, Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Attack of the Rockoids has been well received by critics and readers alike. It's a thrill-a-minute story you'll never forget. A former U.S. military intelligence officer is haunted by intense dreams about a beautiful woman pleading for his help after a terrible battle in outer space. But the dreams turn out to be true and thrust him into a telepathic love affair with a woman whose faraway planet is intent on destroying the Earth. And now the gripping tale continues in The Coming of the Protectors. It's the second book of the Rockoids trilogy, a galaxy-spanning adventure that pits our hapless heroes against powerful, fanatical enemies that threaten the lives of freedom-loving beings everywhere. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors, classic science fiction at its best, available now. For more details, visit Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids.com.
In today's world, violent crime can victimize anyone, anytime. When violent crime confronts you, will you be able to protect yourself and your loved ones? For personal protection training, there's none better than Front Sight, the world's premier firearms training facility near Las Vegas, Nevada. Learn firearm skills from Front Sight's world-class instructors, led by Front Sight's founder and director, Dr. Ignatius Piazza. Whether you're in law enforcement, the military, or a private citizen, after your first firearm training course at Front Sight, you'll leave with skills that surpass 99% of the gun-owning population, guaranteed. And now, you and your family can train at Front Sight free of charge. Yes, free. Go now to frontsight.com/radio to secure a $2,000 four-day defensive handgun course. Absolutely free with no catch. Enter FRONTSIGHT.com/radio. Act now before these free courses are all taken. Secure your free four-day course at frontsight.com/radio. Front Sight, America's gun training destination.
This is George Norrie from Coast to Coast AM and History Channel's Ancient Aliens, and we're proud to promote amazing energy, nutrition, and skincare products from Jeunesse. Visit GCNLife.com for products like Lumines. The Lumines anti-aging skincare line restores youthful vitality and radiance to your skin, reducing the appearances of fine lines and wrinkles with stem cell technology. There's also Instantly Ageless, which works within 2 minutes, reducing under-eye bags, fine lines, wrinkles, and pores. Jeunesse has products to help you with how you look and feel in a very short time. Nobel-nominated Dr. Vincent Jampapa has designed several products helping the body perform better. Jeunesse products have a 30-day money-back guarantee, and they're available up to a 25% preferred price discount. See all of the amazing Jeunesse products at GCNLife.com or call toll-free 1-844-443-6637. 1-844-443-6637.
I'm here with Scott Youseum, founder of OMG Tax. Tell us how your company helps our listeners out there who have a problem with the IRS.
My team of lawyers, enrolled agents, and licensed tax experts remove wage garnishments sometimes in the same day. We even have reduced the total debt some of our clients were required to pay through what is known as an offer in compromise.
Can you give us an example of somebody you help?
Oh, can I ever? We have taken a $500,000 liability with the IRS. Guess what? The client didn't pay a dime through the representation known as non-collectible status with the government.
If you owe the IRS more than $10,000 and you want to see if it's possible to pay a lot less, call OMG Tax right now for a free tax-saving consultation.
Call 800-486-8112. 800-486-8112. 800-486-8112. That's 800-486-8112.
Hello, this is John Burroughs, one of the witnesses to the Rendlesham UFO incident. You're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
There is an emphasis these days in TV fare and movies on showing the LGBTQ community, so that's fine. That's fine. If it is realistic. If it's not, I think they're just really, really pandering to an audience, don't you think?
Absolutely. They could have removed that. I don't think Mimi Hynek had quite the role in the Project Blue Book they portrayed in the program. The other thing, I mean, Project Blue Book was, in the beginning, was a project that had a classification. You just couldn't wander in the office, and yet you see in the program they've got all kinds of windows and all this stuff on bulletin boards. You can peek in the windows and see all of this stuff and people wandering in and out of the office at a whim. Their secretary is an airman basic, the lowest ranking person in the entire military, and she is their secretary. I'm thinking the secretary for something like that would have been an NCO, not an enlisted person of that lower rank. So there were lots of problems like that. And the one thing I noticed, and I'm probably one of like four people in the entire country who would have noticed it, this takes place in 1952, allegedly, and there's an Air Force general in there. I always look at the ribbons that the people are wearing in the movies for, I don't know why, because you know they didn't earn the ribbons, they're just part of the props. But he was wearing an Air Force Commendation Medal. I knew that the Air Force Commendation Medal didn't exist in 1952. And I mentioned it to one of these people, and in the second season, I noticed he no longer was wearing the Air Force Commendation Medal. But bizarre things that I noticed about it, trivia like that. But they interjected these things, and I think you're right, pandering to the audience, whether it's the LGBTQ community or the teenage boys who have to see car chases and explosions, or the female community by bringing Mimi Hynek's role into the forefront. I know later on when Hynek created the Center for UFO Studies that Mimi Hynek became more interested in the UFOs. And during our first archaeological site survey in Roswell, and I shouldn't say loud, but the debris field associated with the Roswell crash, Mimi Hynek was there and participated in it, so she became very interested in this. But I think when you get down to it in 1952, in the early 1950s, when all this was taking place and all the information was pretty much classified, Minnie Hynek wouldn't have had much of a role in anything other than knowing that her husband spent some time away from the home in investigations. And I don't think he spent that much time away from home either, especially in the early years when these things were taking place. Not to mention the chronology from the program is all shot to hell, too. Things that took place long after 1952 show up in prior to 1952, and so it just got kind of weird.
I certainly agree with you there that just reading the plot lines where they cared very, very little about what really happened and they played lip service, you might as well have called this project, X-Files? The Y-Files, that was it, the Y-Files. We had the X-Files. This would be the Y-Files? Or the question being why, Kevin Randall?
If you may not remember, in mid-1970s, I think it was, mid-1970s, Jack Webb, he of Dragnet fame, created a program called Project UFO. And it was basically the same thing. The guys of Project Blue Book were going out and looking at UFO sightings. And they didn't jazz it up with any of that stuff. I think their main thrust was, well, here's a very mysterious UFO sighting, and then they were able to solve it and go off and say, well, it was this or that or the other thing. But at least they didn't get involved in gunfights and fistfights and waterboarding witnesses and all of that stuff. The second season just went completely off the rails, and I didn't even watch the end of the season. I got fed up with it and quit.
Well, Jack Webb also, I think, tried to be closer to the facts, just the facts. Even when he did Dragnet, supposedly they were influenced by actual cases. Not quite ripped from the headlines as it was with Law & Order SVU, but closer to the actual cases. And police officers at the time thought of Dragnet as something really special for the L.A. Police Department. But Jack Webb was, as many of us have learned since, really, really interested in UFOs.
And we need to send a big thank you to him because he is responsible for getting the Project Blue Book files microfilmed. He paid for it because he was going to do the program and he wanted access to the files. They had since been declassified. They'd been at Maxwell Air Force Base for a period of time. Then they'd been sent to the National Archives. And he paid the cost of having the files microfilmed, which meant I could buy copies of the rolls of the film. There were 96 rolls, I think it was, and at the time it was $10 a roll. And as I was doing research on specific cases, I would order the roll. So I eventually ended up with the entire Project Blue Book files on microfilm. And now most of that is on, you can find it online, most of the files online now. I've noticed some gaps in there that cases that are missing from the microfilm, but I've got, from the online files that I've got on microfilm. But he was responsible for having those microfilms, so that was kind of a nice thing for him to do for all of us, it turns out.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I know when I was going through the microfilm online, it was the Blue Book Archives is what I used to use when I wanted it, and now I think you can get it from the Black Vault. But one of the things I noticed is that there were briefings for people about the UFO phenomena prior to the projects themselves taking place, where they would go into some of the history, including some of the even the idea of ancient astronauts. And yet, in there was no mention at all of Roswell. There was of Kenneth Arnold, which happened right around the same time, but nothing about Roswell. Why is that, do you think?
Well, first of all, let me say that there are files that precede the Arnold sighting, case files that precede Arnold in the Project Blue Book files. Project Sign, which was the first investigation, began officially in January of 1948 after Twining ordered that in his September 23rd letter from 1947, ordered the creation of the project. But there was an unofficial project that preceded that, and it began in December of 1946, and a guy named Colonel Howard McCoy was responsible for that. And McCoy had been investigating these unusual aerial phenomena since the Second World War when he was involved in the investigations of the Foo Fighters. So we've got that, and some of the files, very limited number of files prior to the Arnold sighting. But Arnold, of course, is there because that was one of the first ones they investigated. I think Roswell. Let me back up here. Roswell isn't in the files as we've said, but there are other crash cases in the files which turned out to be hoaxes or misidentifications or things that clearly are not alien spacecraft. I think of one from Shreveport, Louisiana in July, I think it's July 7th, 1947. And it was a disc-shaped object that was about 18 inches in diameter, I think, and it crashed into a street. And it had some electronic parts on it, and it was recovered by the Army. J. Edgar Hoover got annoyed because the Army wouldn't let the FBI have it for examination. But it was also an invented hoax. But there's a case file on it in the Project Blue Book files. There's a case on that hoax. Roswell, I think, is not there because it was classified much higher than that. Because everybody agrees something fell at Roswell. We don't all agree on exactly what it was. But had it been an actual alien spacecraft that fell at Roswell, they would have known that. In 1947, they would have, from the wreckage and from the retrieval of the bodies, they would have known that this was not some kind of an earthly craft. And I think that information would have been way too controversial to release at the time. And so since Project Blue Book, I think, had very little to do with top secret materials. It had secret materials and what became classified materials, confidential materials. It didn't have any top secret materials. And I think that the classification removed Roswell from consideration. I think it was classified extremely high based on what they had retrieved. And you look at the timing, July 8th, I think it is, 1947, you have the Roswell Army Airfield announcing they had captured a flying saucer. 3 hours later, Ramey, General Roger Ramey, at the next higher headquarters, 8th Air Force in Fort Worth, says, no, it's a weather balloon. The reporters can't find any information. Jesse Marcel, who is involved and mentioned in the Roswell article, isn't in Roswell. He's in Fort Worth, but the reporters don't know that. They can't find Mac Brazel because he's out on his ranch 75 miles away from Roswell, and they don't know where to find him. And then you've got a general officer saying, well, you know, here's the debris. It's a weather balloon. You know, there's nothing to see here. Go home.
Before you go home, ladies and gentlemen, don't go home. Just listen to this and come back with our guest, Kevin Randall. With Gene and Randall, you're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
We also have swag. You know, we have all these exclusive Paracast things that you can buy. We've got, like, I guess 60 or so different items, and entails T-shirts, sleeves for notebook computers, iPad cases, mouse pads, the Paracast jumbo tote bag, all sorts of T-shirts and jackets and stuff like that for men and women. We have a Paracast aluminum water bottle. All this stuff, you go to store.theparacast.com, store.theparacast.com. What makes it special is that the items are the best quality, you know, great T-shirts, fabrics, and they have our official logo on them. That's what makes them special, in multiple sizes and colors. We even have stuff for children, stuff for women, stuff for men. We have all sorts of sizes, like small up to X large. A lot of good stuff. That's the swag from the Paracast. You go to store.theparacast.com, stop by, and take a shopping tour.
Hi, Peter Picaro for ParanormalDate.com. Are you looking for love in all the wrong places? Now you have a chance to change that by signing up for free at ParanormalDate.com. This incredible dating site puts people of like minds together. People who are interested in the strange, the unusual, mysteries, ghosts, UFOs, and the afterlife, and so much more. ParanormalDate.com was developed for you, people seeking a viable alternative to the other dating services. You can join for free by going to ParanormalDate.com, and if you decide you like it and want to connect with people, use the code GEORGE
for a substantial discount. Mark Rawlings, president of ParanormalDate.com, says so many people hunger to share their experiences about the paranormal, the unexplainable, or the afterlife, and so much more, and this is the source for them to meet and share that common interest. So sign up for free at ParanormalDate.com. ParanormalDate.com. And use the code GEORGE if you decide to connect with someone you like.